This will be a tape recording of a talk given by Cliff Walker of Whittier, California. This talk was given at the General Service meeting of the NCCAA Conference held in Stockton, California, on Saturday, June the 10th, 1972, at 1 p.m. At the time of this talk, Cliff Walker had been sober for 27 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The original recording of this talk was made by Bill Mitchell of Modesto, California, and this cassette was produced from a copy of that original by Bill and Diana Cross of Ashtree Fellowship Tapes, located at 4588 North Meridian, Fresno, California, 93726. Phone number 209-229-8244. This tape was produced in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry this message, and members of the fellowship should bear in mind AA's tradition number 11 regarding anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films in their use of this tape. The total playing time for this recording will be approximately 61 minutes.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It says here in my little paper to qualify myself as a member and also one in GSR from 3 to 5 minutes, so I'll try to do that. Am I too close? Is this all right? Okay. Can you hear me? Okay. Is this better? Is this all right? Well, we have a man taping, and he's asked me to hold back, so I'll do the best I can, Bill. Okay. My name is Betty S., and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Betty.
Hi. I'm really glad to be here and glad to be sober. As an AA member, as an alcoholic, I don't suppose anybody ever got up here accidentally, you know. I've often heard and often thought for a long time that I drank too much, too soon, and too long. But as my 24 hours have added up, I realize that it wasn't too much, or I wouldn't be here at all. But it was enough. And enough happened to me through my career with alcohol. I just went along for a number of years committing the primary wrong as an alcoholic, and that was rejecting all help. Seeing that as a drinking or even a problem drinker, which was all I would admit to, that I could handle it. And if I ever decided to lay off alcohol, I could do that too. But when the time came, very apparently, that alcohol was ruining my life, my children's life, my home life, and I tried to do it alone, I could not. And the most important decision, the most important act of my adult life has been when I called the central office in my hometown in the state of Washington and said with confused mind and shaky body and the whole thing, I need help. That was just what I got. And that's what I'm just still getting. I need help to live comfortably free of alcohol. And that's what AA has offered me above anything else, to be able to live without it a day at a time, but to live comfortably without alcohol and learn about me where the problem really lay. Today is my birthday, and today makes 13 years. I'm a teenager now again, since I attended my first AA meeting. Thank you. I remember getting a hand once, the first time I ever was in a meeting for being a drunk. They all gave me a hand, you know, and I thought, wow, that's more than I've been getting all my other places I've been as a practicing alcoholic. I'm probably not doing this right for our taping.
Go ahead.
Fine. Thank you, Bill. You have a little added thing here. You want to get your thoughts together, and you're hoping you're doing right by the old man here. In my, it suggested just a minute or two of my service life. After having been in AA for a little over 2 years in my home city of Seattle, Washington, I was asked to serve as a GSR. And I don't know about a lot of you here, and I think a lot of you probably are GSRs. I thought, wow, I'm going from the first legacy of our AA triangle, which is recovery, into unity. Really, I'm really moving up in this league, you know. And I was, but in the right way, with the humility that I don't know whether I had any, because if I say I had any, I've immediately lost it. GSR work, service work, has been a great, great rewarding work. I haven't always been as active as I should have been, but I'm aware of that now. But I am in GSR in San Francisco and really glad to be in, because otherwise I wouldn't even be here and be able to share with you on my AA birthday. So thank you for letting me share this little bit about me. Because we're going to get on to one of the main parts of this meeting. And I'm going to call on Mary Pat of Clovis, California, to read. Just a moment now, I'm going to get it right. It's AA's Legacy of Service from our AA Service Manual. So I'll give you now Mary Pat.
I am Mary Pat, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
Grateful to be sober. AA's Legacy of Service by Bill W. Our 12th step, carrying the message, is the basic service that the AA Fellowship gives. This is our principal aim and the main reason for our existence. Therefore, AA is more than a set of principles. It is a society of alcoholics in action. We must carry the message, else we ourselves can wither, and those who haven't been given the truth may die. Hence, an AA service is anything whatever that helps us to reach a fellow sufferer, ranging all the way from the 12th step itself to a 10-cent phone call and a cup of coffee, and on to AA's General Service Office for National and International Action. The sum total of all these services is our third legacy of service. Services include meeting places, hospital cooperation, intergroup offices. They mean pamphlets, books, good publicity of almost every description. They call for committees, delegates, trustees, and conferences. And not to be forgotten, they need the voluntary money contributions from within the fellowship. These services, whether performed by individuals, groups, areas, or AA as a whole, are utterly vital to our existence and our growth. Nor can we make AA more simple by abolishing such services. We would only be asking for complications and confusion. Concerning any given service, we therefore pose but one question. Is this service really needed? If it is, then maintain it we must, or fail in our mission to those who need and seek AA. The most vital, yet least understood, group of services that AA has are those that enable us to function as a whole, namely the General Service Office, AA World Service, and the AA Grapevine, the Board of Trustees, known legally as the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our worldwide unity and much of our growth since early times are directly traceable to this cluster of life-giving activities. Until 1950, these overall services were the sole function of a few old-time AAs, several non-alcoholic friends, Dr. Bob and me, meaning Bill, Bill W. For all the years of AA's infancy, we old-timers had been the self-appointed trustees for Alcoholics Anonymous. At this time, we realized that AA had grown up, that our fellowship was ready and able to take these responsibilities from us. There was also another urgent reason for change. Since old-timers couldn't live on forever, newer trustees would be virtually unknown to the AA groups, now spread over the whole earth. Without direct linkage to AA, future trustees couldn't possibly function alone. This meant that we had to form a conference representing our membership, which could meet yearly with our Board of Trustees in New York, and thus assumed direct responsibility for the guardianship of AA tradition and the direction of our principal service affairs. Otherwise, a virtually unknown Board of Trustees and our too little understood service headquarters would someday be bound to face collapse. Suppose that the future trustees, acting quite on their own, were to make a serious blunder. Suppose that with no linkage to AA, they tried to act for us in a time of great trouble or crisis. With no direct guidance from AA as a whole, how could they do this? Collapse at our top services would then be inevitable. And if, under such conditions, our world services did fall apart, how could they ever be reconstructed? These briefly were the conclusions that led to the formation of the General Service Alcoholics Anonymous. Later, I will outline in more detail the events that have become AA history. The deliberative body known as the conference is made up of elected area delegates from the United States and Canada. Now numbering about 90, together with trustees, the director of the World Service and the AA Grapevine, GSO and Grapevine staff members numbering 30 or more. The conference held its first annual meeting in 1951. Since then, it has met annually in April in New York. It has proved itself an immense success, establishing a record of advisory actions that have served the fellowship well during the intervening years of growth and development. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you, Mary Pat. I would like to mention here that Bill Mitchell, seated here, taping our meeting, tapes all the meetings. And anyone wishing a tape of the meeting, just see Bill right after the meeting and he'll gladly take your order. Right there. I would now like to call on Cliff W. from Whittier, California, who's going to share with us. So welcome, Cliff, please.
Thank you. Thanks, Betty. My name's Cliff Walker, and I'm an alcoholic. Happy to be here again. The last time I came to Stockton, that was many years ago, you brought me up here by plane. I know it costs you a lot of money, I thought. Then I developed laryngitis. And I had to squeak through my talk, but this morning is stomach ache, so, or this afternoon. So I'm improving as far as health. I'd like to thank Norm and the committee, too, for inviting me up here to talk about something that I have a great reverence for, and that is service. And it means a great deal to me. And I probably have a greater appreciation, and I know Stan and all the Oysters probably have a better appreciation of services than some of you that are new. Because we came into AA in the very early days. Well, everything that happened was new, strange, and wonderful. Dr. T. Bow once said this was the miracle phase of Alcoholics Anonymous. We saw so many people coming in, last gasper drunks, who had tried every known means of staying sober and were making it on this new approach. And it was an electrifying experience. In those days, we had very little experience to draw upon. The traditions and the third legacy were still visions of prophecy by Bill. But we did have the big book, which taught us how to stay sober. However, the big book didn't tell us how we started a group. It didn't tell us how to make calls. It didn't tell us about the 13th step. I don't know if any of you up here, you ever have tried the 13th step. That's men calling on women and women calling on men. And it's a real dilly, I'll tell you. It didn't tell us where the proper use of money ended and its misuse began. It didn't tell us not to put any restrictions on who could be members. A lot of things it didn't tell us. So, being alcoholics, we did everything wrong first. And every time you hear the traditions read, that's the accumulation of all our mistakes and corrected mistakes. Because we did everything wrong. If there was a hard way to do something, we found it. In fact, we didn't know that we weren't supposed to organize like other people. So we organized. And the first thing we did at our mother group was to incorporate Alcoholics Anonymous. Not for Southern California, but for the whole damn state. And we were going to give out, people would have to come to us if they wanted to start a group. We was going to give out charters. Well, nobody paid any attention to us. You guys up here in California started without even asking us about it. And we elected a president, a vice president, secretary, a treasurer. And then we formulated some wonderful membership rules. They were really good. In fact, they were so good that if they'd been enforced when we come in, we wouldn't have got in. Those days, we only wanted pure alcoholics. I don't know what a pure alcoholic is, really. But that was one of our rules. And we had a membership committee. Well, you know, members were very hard to come by those days, so we had a goon squad. If anybody relapsed, the goon squad would go out and get them. And the guy might be having a good time at a bar with a blonde, but he got pulled out of the bar, taken home, and sobered up. Well, one time the goon squad got a call out in West Los Angeles, an emergency call. So they dashed out, went to the house, knocked on the door, nobody answered. So they went around the house, looked in the window, and on the bed was a guy passed out. So they jimmied the back door, went in, picked the guy up, took him home, sobered him up, and then they found out they had the wrong guy. This poor guy had come there to paint the house. As far as I know, that guy's still sober. They were wonderful days, but I'd hate like hell to go through them again. Betty said her birthday was today. Do you know something? Today is AA's 37th birthday. How many here knew that? There's one, very few. 37th birthday. In 1935, Bill met Bob and got him sober, and that was the beginning of our fellowship. Those two men, who were within the grasp of oblivion, started a chain reaction of one drunk talking to another that has now spanned the world. You know that Alcoholics Anonymous can be found in almost every major country, even some of the Iron Curtain countries. Over 500,000 of us, 20,000 groups. The sun never sets on some group in the world. How in the world, in 37 years, did we get the way we are? I can't fathom it. But I think there's some very important clues. One of them, I think, was given to us by Dr. Sam Shoemaker in 1905 at the spiritual meeting. He said that God made AA what it is today. God inspired it. Made it grow, kept it going, and gave AA this intangible but unmistakable spirit that you find in every AA group. Bill, in all his writings, and particularly the AA Comes of Age, which I think is a fascinating book, all through the history that he wrote, showed where the loving hand of God steered us around the many pitfalls that we'd have fallen into without this kind of help. Sometimes I think we carry that God help too far. I think a lot of people think that God prints the book. He wrote it. They think probably that God opened up the office and furnished the money to run it. God didn't do that. We had the help. I mean, it's people that keep these things going. That's what our services are. It's people at work, putting us face to face with a guy who is still sick. I think sometimes one of our great services, money. You know, Bill made a mistake, I think, one time. He said, you know, in AA, the material and the spiritual should not mix. But you know, us drunks, we go out and spend $100 a night drinking, but when it comes to putting something in the kitty, we're a little shy, aren't we? That he finally qualified that statement. He said, there's one place where the material and the spiritual can mix, and that's in the basket when they pass it at the meeting. That is a very spiritual thing. And I know in my own life, I've gone out even when I couldn't afford it, and I'd drive 100 miles to give an AA pitch or call on a new baby. That was kind of ego feeding. But when I'd go to the meeting and they pass the basket, I'd look around for a small coin and put it in the basket. And Bill said, you know, it's not very romantic to pay the landlord. But that money is very, very useful. You know, AA's whole financial policy back there is based on St. Francis of Assisi's corporate poverty. Bare running expense plus prudent reserve. And also no outside contributions. I think we should be very proud of the fact that we who were once the takers are now the givers. We pay our own way. Bill also in his writing said that he believed that the in every aspect of this worldwide unfoldment was caused by one big crucial word. And that word is communications. For some reason, God in His goodness gave us 20th century drunks a healing communication amongst ourselves, among the world about us, and with the God of our understanding. Now, from the very beginning, our communications have been no normal transmission of helpful ideas or attitudes. It's been much more. Our communications have always been unique and unusual. Why? Bill says it's because of this kinship and suffering that we have with these other alcoholics. And because our program of recovery, as wonderful it is only effective for us when we're constantly carrying the message to others. That means then that all of our channels of contact are charged with what Bill called the language of the heart, the language of love. Love is a very, very powerful word. But love without responsibility is like faith without works. It's very, very dead. But this is what service is, love and responsibility. They go hand in hand. You know, you look at our program, anybody, a minister, a doctor, or anybody, you'll search in vain for any new fundamental. There's not a new fundamental in our 12 steps. What are the missing links then that our founders added to this chain of recovery? One was this transmission line of one drunk talking to another. And the other was creating a fellowship of our own kind where this new person can work his recovery without criticism or ridicule. Now, how our founders learned to communicate, and communication is actually service. But how they learned to communicate, I think, is probably one of the most fascinating and the most important stories in all our history. I'd like to turn back the pages of history to 34. That's when Bill sobered up. It's time for open-mindedness come along, and he had this phenomenal, bright light, spiritual experience. Those who have read his AA Comes of Age. Bill had been an atheist and didn't believe in God, but when he hit bottom and knew that for him to drink was to die, he threw himself on any power or powers that could help him. And he asked if there was a God help him now. And then he had this bright light experience that the New Yorkers later called his hot flash. But in this period of experience, he also thought he heard a voice telling him to start a chain reaction of one drunk talking to another that would eventually span the world, which it has. However, Bill, being a hardcore salesman, stock salesman, misinterpreted. And the first thing that Bill learned was how not to communicate. But being a power driver and a salesman, he felt that if he had to save every drunk in the world, he better get cracking. So he went out looking for drunks. And he'd find them, and he'd tell them about this bright light experience he had. And he wanted every one of them to have one of those kinds of experiences, not knowing that God comes to people in many different ways. And when they didn't have a spiritual experience, Bill got mad at them. And he'd tell them about their defects of character, and he preached at them. And when they got drunk, Bill got sore. 75 drunk calls later, Bill added up the score of his recoveries. You know, it totaled up to exactly zero. And he got very discouraged. And he went to Lois and said, "Lois, I'm a failure." And Lois said, God bless her, she said, "No, Bill, you're not a failure. You're still sober." Then he went to Dr. Silkworth, this lovable doctor who at that time had already treated 20,000 drunks. in his lifetime and had hardly any success at all. And he told Silky what he had been doing. And this little guy said, "Well, Bill, I think you got the cart before the horse." He says, "You've been going out and preaching to these drunks. You've been telling them about their sins and their defects of character. If I know drunks, they won't buy that unless you can make them see they have to." He said, "No, Bill, I treat these drunks exhaustively. And I tell them how sick they are. I tell them that the habit of drink has become more than a habit. It becomes an all-powerful obsession that the will can't break. And I tell them about this physical thing, this allergy, that increases all the time. And I tell them they finally hit this age-old alcoholic's dilemma, where the obsession for booze guarantees they'll always drink, and the increasing physical thing guarantees they die or go mad. But when I tell them that, they say, 'But Doc, you don't understand. How could you? You never had a serious drinking problem. Also, you can't show me many that have got sober.' But Bill," he says, "I think you're in a wonderful position. Why don't you go out to these drunks and tell your story? Tell them how sick you got from drinking. Use medical terms if you have to. Soften them up. I think, Bill, through your eyes and experience as a recovered alcoholic, you can make them see how sick they really are. And if you can do that, I think they'll buy everything you got, even that God stuff." Shortly after, Bill finally made his first successful rapport with another alcoholic, and that was in Akron, when he found Dr. Bob, a medical doctor. Now, Dr. Bob didn't need spiritual instruction. He had more of that than Bill had. What Bob needed was this deflation and depth that could only come through a guy like Bill. And also only the understanding that only one drunk can give another. But that day in 1935 was a very important thing, because also Bob gave Bill something he needed desperately. And that was the humility of self-forgetfulness and the kinship of one of his own kind. I think that's probably the greatest moment in history for us drunks to come. Because the great insight that these two men shared that day was simply this, that all true communication is founded on mutual need. That never, they found out, never could they talk down to another alcoholic. That the sponsor must always humbly admit his own needs as well as his prospects. And that was the foundation, the basis of our 12th step, carrying the message. The next great insight these two men shared was when they were putting the book together. They knew that they could communicate face to face, but could they communicate in the written word? Would the language of the heart take place? They only wondered, but now we know that the language of the heart does come through the big book. And when they were putting the book together, it was a very trying time for Bob and Bill. Do you know that Lois and Bill lost their home and had to live in the 24th Street clubhouse? They almost starved to death. Dr. Bob and Ann lost their medical practice. But you know, that's sacrificial love at its best. But once they got the book printed, I was going to tell you, though, you know what? Here's a point, I think, a good point to bring out, where God took a hand in our business. When they got the book written, they didn't have a name. So the last-minute vote of the two or three groups they had, they'd had two top names. One was Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other was Way Out. So last-minute vote, they decided to call the big book The Way Out. But over in Washington, D.C., there was one lonely member who had a hunch, if you want to call it that. He went to the Congressional Library to see if there had been any other books written the way out. To his dismay, there had been 12 other books written the way out. And Bill said, you know, I sometimes shudder to think we might have been the 13th way out. But what did we get there? We got not only a name for the book, but a name for our society. And even greater yet, the big tradition of them all, anonymity. The very spiritual foundation upon which this society rests. What literally forces us egotistical, exhibitionistic drunks to be modest before the public. The great tradition. Then they had 5,000 books printed. Now, Bill, to get money to get the book printed, he was selling shares in the big book for $25. And you can tell he was a great salesman because he was selling shares on a book that had never been written to drunks. So when he says, now, when you print the book, I want the thickest pages you got. I want the heaviest kind of cardboard on the cover, so these drunks will really know that they got their money's worth. There was the original big book. You could hardly lift it. But what a sale. Then they encouraged the media. Because there's only 100 people knew about it, plus their families. And they went to the Liberty, and Hausler was then the editor. He printed articles, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And then finally, in 1941, the big article of all, Saturday Evening Post article of 41, Bill called Jack Alexander the Courier of Couriers because that article brought in more AAs than any written piece. I don't know whether you've ever seen the original Saturday Evening Post. It only cost a nickel. But if anyone wants to see it, it shows the pictures and everything else. Anyway, out in California, January or early February, 1940, I'm sitting in my house out in West Los Angeles, coming off of one of the worst binges I ever had. Dorothy and I had tried every possible way for me to stop drinking. I knew I couldn't drink, but I couldn't quit. My demoralization was just terrible. And Dorothy had left the house because I was coming off of this savage binge, and I wasn't very pleasant to be around. But the doorbell rang, and for some reason I opened it. And this was strictly out of character for me. Usually I'd go hide under the bed, but I opened the door. And there was the nicest guy I've ever met. His name was Morton Joseph. And he said, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous, may I come in? And I said, yes. Well, this gent told me an incredible story. He said, Cliff, I was a stockbroker in Denver, and as my drinking got worse, I always had an ace in the hole. If I got to a point I couldn't handle it, I'd go back to managers, and they'd cure me. That point was reached. I went back to managers. They gave me all the tests. And when they were through, they said that I was medically hopeless. Well, he said, you could imagine my demoralization. So I packed the back end of my car with 5 cases of gin and started for Los Angeles, where my brother lived. About 3 months later, he said, I woke up in a Palm Springs hotel with a horrible hangover. And I began looking for the bottle I'd hid the night before in my luggage. And while I was searching through it, I came upon a book, and he showed me the big red. He said, "Cliff, I opened that book, and I began to read." He said, "Do you know that I stayed in that hotel for 3 days and nights without leaving? And I knew this was the answer. But I also sensed that if I wanted to keep this thing, I had to give it away. I had to work with other alcoholics. So I got a hold of New York, and they told me the nearest group was in Los Angeles. And it was a non-alcoholic woman named Kay Miller had started meetings in 39. So I moved to Los Angeles to be near a group. I went up to see Kay. And Kay was packing for Hawaii. And when I asked her where the meetings were being held, she says, "Well, they're not meeting anymore." And Mort says, "Why?" He said, "Because everybody's drunk," which is normal in 39. So I said to Kay, "Kay, don't you have any calls I can make? Or I need the work." She said, "Well, there's a whole waste paper basket full of them, but they don't want to stay sober." And in that waste paper basket was Dorothy's letter to Bill Wilson and Ruth Hawk. Dorothy had read about AA and, of all things, Beatrice Fairfax Clyde, and sent a letter to New York. And Kay had called me. But I wasn't an alcoholic, and she was a non-alcoholic, too. I told her I didn't need it. Anyway, that's what brought him to my house. Then Mort said, "Cliff, you know, Kay's been meeting in homes. In Pasadena and Glendale and in her apartment. I want to find a public place where we will be accessible to drunks who are in need. Said, if I find such a place, will you come?" And I said, "Yes." I didn't have any desire to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't an alcoholic. An alcoholic was this guy back in Liberal, Kansas, who everybody kicked him out of town, and a ridiculous figure, not me. But I had to see Mort again. I somehow sensed that he had lived in this strange and lonely world that I had lived so long. Something got to me. It attracted me. And I had to see this guy again. I read something not too long ago that I think explains this, at least to me. Said that the first candle brought into a dark room is the most important. 100 more candles may shed more light, but it's the first one that dissipates the darkness. How important first impressions are, and how long-lasting, particularly for us alcoholics. We have a tradition that says we grow by attraction rather than promotion. But in my book, the attraction starts with a guy or a gal who makes the first call. How they handle it. This guy's back in this dark cave. Hates everybody. If sure they would, if they've heard about AA at all, it's probably been from some AA reject. And he's back in this Kirk cave, and you go in there and you explain this thing to him. And they'll come to the meeting just to see you again if we make it attractive enough. The first meeting should be attractive. That's the way we grow. That's the kind of people we are. Anyway, Mort called me later in the day, or later in the week. I found a place down on 6th or 7th and Main, and that's right in the heart of Skid Row at the Cecil Hotel. Meet me down there next Friday night. And I said, "Okay." So I go down to 7th and Main Street. That's familiar territory of mine. And, you know, I had to go through a bar to get in the hotel. I never did find out they had another entrance. I guess I was testing myself. But up in the balcony lobby, we held our first meeting of the mother group. And I'll never forget it. There's probably half a dozen of us in various stages of sobriety or drunkenness, whatever you want to call it. And when finally Mort started the meeting, he said, "You know, I've never been to an AA meeting. I don't know what we're supposed to do. They must have some format, but I don't know what it is." But then he told the group about what happened to him by reading the book in the Palm Springs Hotel. And he had been sober then by 3 months. Then he said, "You know, fellows, I am convinced that the principles incorporated in this big book, written by recovered alcoholics, will bring sobriety on an all-time basis to any alcoholic in the world that really wants to quit drinking. Says, you know, I don't know of a better way to start this meeting than to read those principles." So he opened the old big book to page 70, read the preamble, the 12 steps, and the paragraph afterwards. And I'm sure that Mort was much wiser than he knew, because he is saying, in effect, "I know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. What I say is my opinion. If you want the real message, it's in the big book. Principles before personalities." Yeah. Which this is now a custom in all over Southern California, and I'm glad that I don't know how you got started, but it's a good thing, because if you read Bill very much, you'll probably read his article about the healing process of repetition. And it's quite remarkable, because repetition is the greatest form of emphasis in the world. Ask any advertiser. And we go to these meetings, and somebody reads the 12 steps, and we turn them off after a dozen meetings. We think. But the subconscious is always taking this in. I know, because I hated the 12 steps at first. They weren't pertinent to my problem. When they said, "What is your problem?" I said, "I just drink too much." Dorothy tells me when I'm sober, I'm a hell of a nice guy. It's only when I get drunk she calls me a revolving bastard. I ask her later when I got sober, "Why'd you call me a revolving one, honey?" She says, "Well, any angle I looked you from, you're still a bastard." She had lots of reasons. And, you know, after a year, year and a half, I got a job and I had to drive clear across town. I finally got put on night shift. It scared the hell out of me because they only had one meeting. But you know, I found out driving to and from this place in Huntington Park, I could repeat the preamble, the 12 steps, and the paragraph afterwards. I hadn't tried to learn them, I just knew them. And I said it for protection. The healing process of repetition. That's why meetings are important. You hear it over and over, "I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable." After all, that was pretty repetitive things we did in the bar, too, wasn't it? Well, 1951, I think it was, standing here, when they had the first General Service Conference, I was selected as a delegate from our area. And I went back to New York. We were only half of us there at that time. And I saw something that really almost threw me into a depression. I went back there and I found out, here is the source of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found out that we had forgotten them. The big book had kept them going back there for many years, but the expansion of groups and the inflations, they were going broke. And the grapevine was losing $1,000 a month. The book reserve was almost completely exhausted, and their morale was very low. And I saw, well, my God, the cause why AA grew and prospered throughout the world, and we've forgotten them. When I come back to California, God, I was really on fire. And I did everything wrong. Talk about communications. I sure learned how not to communicate, too. Because I was so enthralled about it, I'd go out and I'd preach to these drunks. I'd tell them, I'd cuss them out. You're too damn coy about money. And I finally began getting 86th out of groups, of all things. They'd meet me at the door and say I was supposed to talk, and they said, well, the committee says, Cliff, if you want to give your story, you can come in and talk, but if you're going to talk about services, they don't want you. And I said, well, by God, if I can't talk about services, I ain't going to talk. And you'd be surprised how many times I didn't talk. Next year I went back and I told Bill what I'd been doing. God love him. He said, Cliff, now put yourself in those guys' shoes out there. They've never been back here. They've never seen this thing. After all, what's an AA's first responsibility is himself, his own sobriety, isn't it? Then it's his new baby or babies. Then it's his own group, maybe a central office. But this thing way back is too remote. Cliff, he says, if you can show these people that this thing back here is directly responsible for their survival, if it ever collapses, they won't survive. None of us will. If you can show them the need, I know AA, they'll take care of it. And that's when I come back. Instead of talking an hour on and giving all the details, I talked about service and the concept of service. I mean, service is like a... Well, supposing you had a beautiful car, you got a gasoline in it, spark plugs, everything, the most perfect engine. But it's a dead thing until you add the spark, isn't it? And service is the spark that spiritually animates us people. It's the thing that makes us tick, makes us function, makes us grow. Where would we be without this big book? Where would we be without the somebody to answer the phones? I mean, like here in your area, in San Francisco, in Stockton, and in Sacramento. It's only through service that we can find our new drunks and get face to face with them. I hope people will take a better look at service. And so many feel, well, they do fight down there. My God, we've always fought. Usually, though, on how to do the most good for the most drunks. And some lesser things, too. But after all, service is that important. I think Dr. Sam was right at St. Louis when he said God made AA what it is today. But I think he expects us to do our part. And it's only through service that we can do it. Do you know in AA there's a niche for every one that comes in? Not speaking. There's a coffee maker's job. There's a greeter at the door job. There's secretary, treasurer, your institutional work. Local office work, going into schools, educating other people's children. There's a niche for everybody. I mean, the sum total of all these things is the third legacy of service. Yes, God, I think Sam was right. Dr. Sam also said something that morning in St. Louis, I've never forgot. He said he felt that the greatest need today was a worldwide spiritual awakening. And he felt that maybe Alcoholics Anonymous was a sign that would happen in our time. That's kind of heady wine for us drunks to dwell on, but he may be right. Because, you know, all through history, God has worked through human weakness to demonstrate his healing power. Could he find any more of any people who have less respectability than us drunks, us children of the darkness, who for countless ages have marched into oblivion? That's the first time in history that alcoholics or drunks have been, stayed sober en masse. You know that Herbert Hoover, one of our presidents, talked before the UN Assembly one time for about 20 minutes about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told them, he said, that they would embrace our principles of in our traditions, there would be no more wars. Well, what happened? They sent out a delegation to see Bill. Because Bill was televised, he said, my God, imagine those people asking the drunks to save the world. And he says, well, Teddy whined, but he says, I think we got 30 million alcoholics in the world today. I guess we better take care of them first. Anyway, but a guy did, when he administered the Marshall monies in Greece, he used our tradition of self-help and built 20,000 miles of roads in Greece. And every one of these villages, he'd go in and ask them what they would do to help. And he would furnish the materials and the money to do it, and the machinery. And those people kept their self-respect. Anyway, somehow, I think Herbert Hoover also told them that AA has been permitted to achieve something that's never happened in the world before. And that we have been permitted to achieve the age-old philosophers of dream of one world. Now, it's still in miniature, but we have spanned the world. In this wonderful AA world of ours, we hotly differ about many things, don't we? But we never think of division and conflict for a solution. Even in the old days, we might get mad as hell and have a lot of fights. But when the chips were down, we closed ranks very quickly. Because we had this basic instinctual awareness that of our need for one another. We knew that we hang together or we hang separately. We fought a great deal. We are in our world, we've forsaken the pursuit of fame, of prestige, or money. And as we've been able to perfect the language of the heart, we've been able to cross over all the barriers of distance, of language, of social distinction, of race, creed, color, all the things that the world is fighting about today. In AA, paraphrasing Satchmo, where AA is, segregation ain't. Now, I think we should all remember, and that's one good thing about these big meetings, they give us a larger vision of the whole. But if we remember that this wonderful AA world of ours is God's gift and not created by any particular talents or abilities that we have, we should remember always to keep our channels of contact open, make them wider and deeper to find more drunks. After all, there's 35 million men and women suffered alcoholism in our lifetime of AA. We've only a little over 500,000, a good record. But it's no time for complacency. We should always be inclusive, too, of those in need. I think also we should remember that Bill and Bob never put any limitations on their work. We should never do that. In our 12-step work particularly, I think we should go to those people and explain this thing to them. And I hope we do something else. You know, a great man named Santana once said that people who fail to remember the experience of the past are condemned to relive them. And that's doubly true of us, I think. I hope more of us will begin to read the history. Because AA today, as wonderful as it is linked to equally wonderful AA of the past. And AA's successes today are accumulations of that past. and can only be a promise for the future if we pass these things along. I mean, that service manual, that's very important. 12 and 12. And one of the most important of all is the A comes of age, because that lays... Bill spent 25 years painstakingly, thoroughly recording the experience for the drunk sheep. I think we should remember that our program is not made up of just recovery or one legacy. It's actually a spiritual entity made up of three legacies: recovery, unity, and service. The 12 steps have taught us how to stay sober. Their principles of conduct, if we practice, will unify us very divided personalities and make us whole. Our 12 traditions are also principles of conduct for us to practice individually. If we practice them individually, our collective conscience will be clear, won't it? And it teaches us to relate ourselves with each other and the world about us, and that is very important. But the third legacy, service. That's where AA is at. That's what it is. That's our main purpose. That's why we're here today. As Bill said, anything that puts us face to face with a new drunk is a service. It's a reminder that Alcoholics Anonymous is more, as than Bill said, a set of principles. It's actually a worldwide spiritual fellowship of men and women alcoholics in action. We must carry the message. If we don't, we ourselves will die, and the drunks from tomorrow and for all for centuries will die because we didn't care enough to give them the same chance that you and I have had. Thank you.